start with our motivation. Okay, so we've been learning about karma, and it's due to karma that we all have the opportunity to be here this evening, having created causes in previous lives, or perhaps earlier this life, but most likely previous lives. And then the causes and conditions coming together so that those karmic seeds were able to ripen in our having the ability to listen to the teachings tonight. So all these things are dependent arisings occurring due to multiple causes and conditions. And so they're things that are not stable. They're not to be taken for granted, because everything that is under the influence of other causes and conditions, with the slightest change in even something small, then the whole situation can be very different. So for that reason, when we have some good conditions, we should really cherish them and relish them and make good use of them. And to do that by creating more good causes, to bring more good situations, and not only good external situations, being able to hear the teachings, but to create the causes to understand the teachings by listening attentively, remembering what was said, thinking about what was said afterwards and applying it to our lives, and then reviewing it again and again so that it sticks in our minds and it influences how we live. So we want to do that also with bodhicitta as our motivation for being here this evening, putting that thought into our mind stream again and again and again, remembering its benefits, and remembering that it's really the only decent thing to do, considering the kindness that we've received from others. So let's aspire for full awakening so we can benefit others more effectively as we're on the path and after we attain the result. So there was a question that somebody wrote from last week. Let's start with that. Okay, so she's saying, I find the mind training and mindfulness aspects of the water bowl practice useful, about how far to space the bowls, how much water to put in, etc. So having those kind of descriptions of, you know, the bowl's supposed to be filled within the width of a grain of rice, you know, from the top, and not further apart than a grain of rice, and in a straight line. That's very good for being attentive and careful, okay? Yet, the idea that accidentally spilling some water will be a cause for loose ethics doesn't quite feel right. If there was no intention, then why would there be karma? So, this is an interesting question. I've been pondering this question for a number of years, actually, because having heard all these kinds of things. And I remember when we were, when Kenzin Trungpa Tenpo was teaching about prostrations, you know, we heard the things that, you know, if your hands are like this, when you go down, you're going to be born as a cow. And like this, you're going to be reborn as a bird. And, you know, okay. So, but then, when it came to, you know, because in the Tibetan tradition, you put your thumbs in. But if you don't put your thumbs in, this was absolutely the wrong way to bow. And I forget what the bad consequence was. I can't, does anybody remember? There's some bad consequence. And then somebody brought up the fact that in all the other Buddhist traditions, this is how they hold their hands. So does that mean that all the other Buddhist traditions are creating, you know, some kind of negative karma by holding their hands this way? Yeah. So, at that time is when I started to wonder, where did some of these stories and things come from? What's really the source? When we, you know, because there's a lot of these kinds of things. Stories, you know, in the long rim, and warnings about different karmic things. When we were at the teachings, you know, last month, then I was sitting next to a lady from, where was she from, Shanghai?
I think so.
Yeah. So we didn't even speak the same language. But we were doing mandala offerings to His Holiness, so I had my fingers like this. She was terribly worried because I didn't have my mala around my fingers. Because I don't carry my mala with me, you know, I don't wear it or anything because I feel it's, because for some people it becomes like adornment and jewelry, so I don't wear it. But she obviously heard, I had never heard this one before, but she obviously heard that if you do this without your mala, then you're creating the cause not to have food. So she very kindly gave me this beautiful mala because she was so concerned and worried about me not having food. And I really appreciated her kindness, but I was wondering, where did this come from? Because I haven't, have any of you heard that one? I haven't heard that one. So, you know, she heard it from somewhere. I don't know, maybe her teacher in Shanghai, you know. Then I also remember hearing, the Tibetans have one, that you do not offer your teacher shoes because that creates the cause to be separated from your teacher because it's like asking them to go away. So you never offer shoes to your teacher. So I thought, that means your teacher's supposed to get barefoot, go barefoot. You know, they have thousands of devoted disciples who don't want to be separated from them, but let them walk around barefoot, stepping on all sorts of glasses and rusty nails. So, you know, I've really had some qualms about these. And we asked one of the Geshe's, the younger Geshe's, about some of this. And he said he wondered about the sources for them too. Okay? So, you know, all I can tell you is that it would be very interesting and very good to have somebody really do some research about the sources of all these things. And where did they come from? Did they come from one person's oral teaching? Did they come from a sutra? You know, where did these things come from? Because I can imagine some of them, you know, if you want to really encourage people to be careful when they're pouring the water and, you know, on the water bowls and not make a mess and to be respectful, that if you said something like that, it would really make people be more careful. But then, is it true? Yeah, especially you have no intention. The water got spilled accidentally. Karma is volitional action where there's an intention. So, you know, how does that work? So I think it would really be very good to find somebody who wanted to trace these things back and find out where they came from and what is just kind of folklore and what actually has sutra references to it. You know, because you can see in some of the texts, you know, and you can see how I mean, everywhere that Buddhism spreads, it's taken into the culture, or put it this way, the culture is put on top of the Dharma. And so we often forget about this, and also when you're so familiar with, if you're the member of a certain culture and certain things have always been done a certain way and you've always heard certain things, then you never really ask what the source is and you never stop to discern what is culture and what is the Buddha's word. Yeah. And I know for me when I went to Taiwan, that was one of the big questions I was asking because I had spent many years in the Tibetan tradition learning how to do things, you know, their way. And then I went to Taiwan and you do things completely different. Instead of sit all day, you stand all day. Yeah? And then differently, you know, you were told to, in the Tibetan tradition, you kneel one way. In the Chinese tradition, you kneel another way. Does it really matter how you kneel? Or is what is more important what's in your mind? So, some interesting things. Because I've seen some people get really very picky about these kind of external details. I remember what it was. A group of us was at Vatapani and we were, they were making, you know, big water offerings around Lama Stupa. And apparently Rinpoche has said, you know, don't put your fingers in the water that's offered. And, which makes sense. But then one day there was a bug drowning in the water and I went to put my finger in to save the bug and someone said, oh, don't put your finger in the water, and went off to get something else. And I did it anyway because otherwise the bug was going to die. Yeah. So some of these things, the way they're told, you know, we sometimes get very literal about them and it sounds like one small action, you know, like, you know, spilling a few drops of water is going to make you have loose ethics, completely ignoring the fact that not learning the precepts, not developing a sense of integrity and consideration for others, not developing conscientiousness, are going to be bigger causes for having loose ethics than spilling a few drops of water. Okay? So I think, you know, with these things we need to really, you know, think more deeply and ask more questions and, you know, what really are causes for what. Yeah? Because, I mean, we all grew up with, what was it, step on a crack, break your mother's back, remember? Remember that one, and not walking under ladders, and oh, these poor black cats, you know, but our black cat, Manjushri, was somebody wonderful. Yeah, you guys didn't meet Manjushri, most of you, but he was a wonderful cat, quite wise cat. His body didn't start to smell until 5 days after he died. we're not quite sure who that cat was.
Yeah.
Highly unusual. So I think, you know, yeah, let's just think more deeply about this. Okay. And then there's a question. With the story of the fly around on the cow dung, circumambulating the stupa, accumulating the merit to be ordained. You know, that makes it sound, yeah, like all you need to do to be ordained is sit on a piece of cow dung that floats around a stupa. You know, let me tell you, it takes a lot more than that to have the good fortune to be ordained. It takes an incredible amount of virtue to be able to take the precepts. You know, it takes a whole lot. In the case of this story, you know, it was an old man, and it was Mogliana, I think, who was the chief in the super knowledges, and he couldn't see the karma. So the story is also told, not just as a story about karma, but a story about how the Buddha's powers are much better than the Arhat's powers, because Mogliana couldn't see that little bit of karma, but the Buddha could. Okay? So, you know, in that kind of story, it's like that old man had a whole lot of good karma. He needed one little itty bit more. You know, he needed those two drops more in the bucket. And that's what his life, you know, floating around. You know, but then somebody could have said, oh, you create negative karma sitting on cow dung going around a holy object like a stupa. Somebody could very reasonably say that, and it would make some sense, wouldn't it? You know? Yeah, I mean, disrespecting the stupa. So, but, you know, so we need to, you know, really consider these things more, okay? And because a lot of them are told as if one small thing were the only karma that's needed for having this big result. And so it's true, you know, the second principle of karma, that small actions can bring big results. Yeah, but most things usually, you know, you need many, many causes, especially when it's something that's highly virtuous. You need a lot of virtuous causes to be able to bring that result. Okay, are you ready to go on? For those of you, here's another example. You know the story about the dog's tooth? Yeah, that, I'll tell it for the people who don't know it. There was an old lady who very much, her son was going away on a pilgrimage to India, and she very much wanted a relic of the Buddha. So she said, please bring something back. So the son went, he came back. On his way back, he remembered that he was supposed to bring a relic of the Buddha, but he hadn't. So, he's walking along, he saw the carcass of a dead dog. He pulled out a tooth from the dead dog. When he got home, and his mother said, did you bring a relic? He gave her the dog's tooth, and he said, this is the Buddha's tooth. So he's lying. What kind of karma is that? Okay, so and so the mother has incredible devotion to this dog's tooth. She bows to the dog's tooth because she thinks it's the Buddha's tooth. She bows to it. She makes offerings to it. She prays to it. And the dog tooth, what was it? It started having increasing, didn't it? You know, that's what they say about the relics, that they increase, more little things come out of them. So I asked his holiness about that one time, and he said, that's a silly story. Huh? Yeah? years later, I did hear him tell it. But you know, he's going to say different things for different people according to their, yeah, their mentality and so on. So it was in front of a group of Tibetans that he told it, you know, to me, to Suzette, you know. Okay, so we were talking about the 10 paths of non-virtue. So last week we talked about taking life. Okay. So second one is stealing, or the literal translation is taking what hasn't been given, which I think sometimes is better to use rather than stealing, because we all think, I don't steal. You know, stealing is what really nasty people do in the middle of the night. Okay, I don't steal. But do we take things that haven't been freely given to us? Yeah, we do, don't we? Yeah. We often can take things that haven't been freely given to us. So sometimes the terminology gets us to think a little bit more. Okay, so with all of these, we've been going through the four parts: the object, the attitude, the action, and the conclusion. So here, the object is an object of value belonging to someone else that you take for yourself. So this, if it's something that's half owned by you and half owned by the another person, then even if you take the whole thing, it's not a full action of stealing because it didn't belong completely to you at the beginning. But also, as the object, it includes taxes, fares, tolls, and fees, and things like this that we're supposed to pay. Now, how many people, well, there's also, we're going to get into lying, but how many people tell the truth on their income taxes? Yeah. A few people do. Yeah. Some people don't. Yeah. Or some people, you know, when you can get in the back door of the theater, you go in the back door without paying for the ticket. You know, there's all sorts of little things that we can do to avoid paying fees and tolls and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. Like, I don't know if you remember, they used to have it so that children under 12 had a lower thing. Yeah? So, were you ever over 12 pretending to be under 12? Yeah? So, think, you know, things like that. So, yeah. And it also refers to, like, things, if you're working at a company, things that belong to the company. I remember in the good old days when people were first using calling cards, hardly anybody had them. And one person would get a hold of the number of some big company that, you know, some employee could use to make long distance calls, and then share that number with all their friends, and then all the friends would use that number. So, you know, things like that. Or not only that, but, you know, using things that belong to the company for your own personal welfare, whereas you're not supposed to do that. If the company gives permission for it, then it's okay. But if your company doesn't, and you, you know, you mark down that what wasn't a business dinner was a business dinner. Yeah, lots of people do that kind of thing. Or, You know, you look, you think of all the white collar crimes, where, you know, people have given you money to invest, you make bad business deals, knowing they're bad business deals, yeah, but you make some profit off of it. Is that lying, or is that stealing, or is it maybe both? Yeah, because somebody entrusted their money to you, it wasn't yours. Yeah. Cooking the books? Yeah, how many businesses cook their books? Yeah, as we all know by reading the newspaper, quite a number of them do. Okay, so all of these come under stealing. So we don't have to think of stealing as being something that, you know, only naughty robbers do who come in the middle of the night and terrorize people. You know, you can put on a suit and tie and go to Wall Street or go to, you know, Wilshire Boulevard and steal too. It's quite interesting how our society views these two kinds of stealing as different, whereas karmically, you know, they're probably very, very similar. Of course, if you use a weapon when you break into somebody's house, that's another element. Yeah. But certainly what the white-collar crimes are really atrocious, how people are taken advantage of. Okay, so then in terms of the attitude, you have to correctly identify what you intend to steal. If somebody loans you something, and you forgot that it was loaned to you, and instead you think it's yours, it's incomplete. Yeah, because you didn't identify an object and have the intention to steal. Somewhat similarly, if you borrow $10, but you forgot how much you borrowed from your friend, so you only repay $5, you know, you don't have the intention to steal it, you know, so it's not... It's not karma-free, but it's not a complete action. And the thing about being a complete action is complete actions have the power to give forth all of the karmic results, whereas incomplete actions may only give out partial results, may only bear partial results. For stealing, you can have any of the three afflictions as a motivation. It could be attachment, you know, you want to get what the other person has. It could be anger, that you want to make somebody else suffer, like an army who's plundering. You know, after they win a battle, they go into the village and plunder. So it's out of anger that they're stealing, or, you know, you really want to harm somebody so that they don't have it. So you steal out of anger. Or you steal out of ignorance. Apparently, you know, in ancient times, Brahmins thought that if a Brahmin was poor, it was okay to steal. Or that if somebody was old, it was okay to take their stuff. You know? So, or we just think that, you know, well, what's wrong with stealing? Oh, you know what's a good example of stealing with ignorance? This is a big multinational company. It steals from people all the time. I'm going to take something from them, and it's what I deserve anyway, and they're not going to miss it. So that's stealing, an example of stealing with ignorance. There might be, what, a tinge of anger in there too, do you think? Yeah? Depending on the person, maybe a tinge of attachment. But a lot of ignorance, like, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. They take other people's stuff, I'm going to take their stuff. Then the action can be done in several ways. One is you can threaten somebody through, you know, physical power, threaten them to, so that they have to give you something. You can't just go in and take it without anybody noticing. You can cheat somebody, you know, like with fraudulent transactions, making the weights, you know, on something different. You know, you used to have to go to the marketplace and weigh things, but, you know, your 1 kg stone actually weighs, you know, 90 grams instead of actually a kg. And so that way you're selling people not a full kg, just stealing in that way. It can also involve like really coercing somebody to the point, you know, verbally coercing somebody to the point where they really can't say no. You know, you put so much pressure on them, they're, you know, you're saying this in front of a whole group of people and they're, you know, they're really stuck. So they give something. They don't, it's not freely given. It's given because they've been coerced. Okay. Then the culmination is feeling that the object now belongs to you. Okay? So it's now mine. I remember one of my teachers saying, you know, when if somebody steals something from you, as soon as they think it's mine, it's a full action of stealing, even if we, out of some kindness for the person, not wanting them to have that heavy karma, mentally give them the act, the object afterwards. But if before we've mentally given it to them, they've thought, now it's mine, then it's a full action of stealing. And then somebody said, where did I read that? Oh, I remember. It was in the Shikshamana trainings, yeah? That if somebody steals something from you and they think, now it's mine, if you go and take it back from them without asking, then you're stealing the object from them. I wonder, you know, it makes sense from the viewpoint of that person thinks now it's mine. Yeah, so you're taking something from someone that considers an object theirs. But it doesn't make sense from the viewpoint of it's not really theirs. And, you know, the police could come and take it back for you and everybody would think that that was quite fair. That's another thing I think might be interesting to check. Okay? So some other things that are stealing. If, you know, when there's puja or teachings or something, and they're handing out offerings, if we take twice the amount, yeah, then that's stealing. Yeah? Maybe the person's distributing the money and they... Two people come and give you, yeah, and you don't say, oh, I've already received and give it back, but you keep it, that's stealing, okay? So also fining people in excess, if you charge too much, if you are in a position of fining people for wrongdoings and you do that in an unfair way, that constitutes stealing. Okay, obliging somebody to give money, even though they want to, by coercion. Okay. When you borrow something, having the intention not to return it. Thinking, oh, I'll borrow it, and then I'll just keep it and they'll forget about it. Yeah. We've lost an amazing number of library books at the Abbey. Even ones that have stickers on them with the Abbey's name. And we're never sure, did somebody just forget to return it, even though it has a sticker on it? Or did they take it thinking the Abbey, we can't imagine anybody taking it thinking, well, they'll never know. But, you know, it's a puzzling thing when there's an actual name on it that people somehow forget to return it. So we should be very careful with things that we borrow, okay? Now the question often comes, what about if the person who owns the thing isn't around to ask if it's okay to use it? If there's somebody who you know very well And you know that if you ask them that they would say yes, then you can take it, leave them a note so that they know where their whatever went and they don't freak out when it's not there. You know, I borrow this and that, I'll return it this and such a time. Don't worry, it's safe. And as somebody you know very well, then it's okay to do that. Yeah. If it's, you know, for other things, we really have to wonder what to do. I always wonder about this, like, it's going to sound funny, but you know how the mail person often puts rubber bands around the mail, and people take the mail out of their mailbox in the city and just throw the rubber bands on the ground? Yeah. So if you see the rubber bands on the ground and you pick them up, because you need some rubber bands, is that stealing? Or what about if you pick the rubber bands up because they're littering the street and you pick them up to throw them away? Okay, so this is an object that is not something of any value, so you know already you don't have the full action there. But it's an interesting question if something, some insignificant thing like this has been intentionally discarded. I would think that it's not stealing, you know, because, for example, in Japan, many people put quite good furniture out on the street because they bought new furniture, and they put it out on the street, and it's okay with them if somebody else takes it or if the garbage truck takes it. They don't really care. In that kind of situation, I think it's fine to take it. They've given up ownership on it. Yeah, it doesn't really belong to anybody. Yeah?
I was thinking like in the colonialism where, you know, colonial powers take over the lands.
Yeah.
So the first generation, I think, is stealing. But what about the second and the next generation that continues to live on the land?
Yeah.
Do they some karma of the stealing?
Okay. Interesting question. So when you have colonialism and the first generation comes over there, there is stealing. I mean, they're definitely taking what doesn't belong to them. It's taken by force and so on. But what about when the second, third, and fourth generation? You know, if there's still armies in there threatening the people, then I would say it's still stealing. You know, if the armies are there and watching who's doing what, and I would say it's still stealing. Yeah?
Well, according to Sherman and Alexis, we should all leave Washington State real quick.
Yeah, I mean, when you look and, you know, the land that we're on has been, was stolen from the Native Americans. Very clear.
And that would include just about every place in the United States and beyond. So.
Yeah. But I've also often thought, you know, it's very interesting that we've never compensated the Native Americans for their land. Yeah. It's interesting to watch the government. You know, for the Japanese who were interned during World War II, they gave them all $20,000. I had a friend who was a child in an internment camp, and when they wanted to give him $20,000, he just, you know, was like, hey, this, don't think money is gonna wash that away. But, you know, with the Native Americans, never had any recompensation. Yeah? So, how does that work? Yeah. And colonial powers certainly haven't compensated the lands that they've colonized and stolen from. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stealing that goes on in this world, isn't there? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So then you've got the muddled mess of that Oregon Reserve and the militiamen who say that it's the people around there's land, and the government saying, no, it's everybody's land. So, I mean...
Yeah. Well, there you have some laws in place.
Okay, so...
And it's federal land, and it's illegal to point a gun at a federal officer. Yeah. There's laws in place. Yeah. And this land, actually, a century and a half ago, they were trying to get rid of it, and nobody wanted it. So they made it federal land. Yeah. So these people who are occupying it, it's not their land. Okay, what else? Okay, if you might steal something, you know, and then feel bad about it and pay it back or give it back to the person. So if you had that kind of thought that you were going to pay them back for it before you stole it, then the karma's not as strong. You know, it's still a full action because you took it. If you think after you've taken it, you know, you've had it for a while, and then you thought, gee, I should really pay them back, the action's still complete, but at least by paying it back, you reduce the heaviness of the karma and you create some merit. We had somebody who came here at one point who had taken out a loan in another country and not paid it back and felt really horrible about it now, you know, because he'd become a Buddhist. But he didn't know how to go and pay it back. Yeah. Because it would be difficult to go to the bank in another country. And I don't know. So, interesting question. But, yeah. A lot of stealing. So it's something to be really careful about. They say also, especially in terms of the Sangha community, we have to be very careful because if things belong to the community and without permission we just take it for ourselves, then that becomes stealing from the community. And stealing from the Sangha becomes very heavy because there's many people who are involved in the community. And so unless you return it or pay it back to the exact people who were there at the time you stole it, then still something is lost. So that's why very often we have somebody who's in charge of certain things. And so if you want a certain... you need a certain thing, you go ask the storekeeper, they say yes, no, or maybe. Or often we have, because we're a small community right now, we have a common agreement that we've already made that if people need, you know, if you need a new pair of socks, you can just go and get the pair of socks from the, you know, the room. But it's good to tell somebody afterwards. But, it, you know, to be quite careful about those kind of things. Or taking things that belong to the Sangha and giving them to our personal friends. Of course, if we ask the community first and they say yes, you know, then that's fine. But if we just think, oh, you know, nobody's using this, I can take it, and then we give it to a personal friend and so good. Okay, then the third one is unwise and unkind sexual behavior. So this one, I can either teach you in the traditional way according to Vasubandhu, in which case you're going to flip out. Yeah. This is always in India when you teach a course, the thing that people flip out the most over. Or I can teach it in a more modern way. Okay. Alex person has done a lot of thought about this kind of thing, you know, because he really noticed that the traditional way, that was according to Vasubandhu, these things are not necessarily even in the sutras or the Vinaya. It's Vasubandhu who especially elaborated on this particular precept. And Alex, you know, says it's taught for for heterosexual males, and of course not every heterosexual males in a country where having concubines and prostitutes is completely okay. Okay, so I think this one, I talked to one Geshe about this one, and we kind of agreed that this one depends a lot on the culture. Yeah? Because, for example, yeah, in Tibetan culture, or at least in old Tibet, men often had many wives. No, wives. One woman often had many husbands. Yeah? Now, can you imagine in our culture, and that was perfectly acceptable in Tibet, it wasn't considered unwise or unkind sexual behavior. Could you imagine saying that in our culture? Oh yeah, women can have many husbands, men can have many wives. Would that be appropriate for our culture? I think people would flip out. Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't fit the culture. And so similarly, some of these things, like I nearly went through the ceiling one time. Somebody was teaching this, one Lama was teaching it. And he said, it's sexual misconduct if somebody else pays for the prostitute, but you sleep with her. I nearly went through the ceiling on that one. You know, it's like, don't you realize that for most women, prostitution is not the career of choice that they voluntarily take up? You know? And that they're, you know, they're coerced by economic situations or by, you know, extreme family situations or who knows what. So how you know, and then you have in our culture people imprisoning the prostitutes, but the johns and the pimps, it's fine. And the parents in very poor societies who give their daughters away, so the daughters can go to the city and be prostitutes. The daughters get in trouble, the parents don't. You know, I think we need to really take another look about prostitution and what's going on here before we start saying what's okay and what's negative karma, what's not negative karma. Personal opinion there. But I bet I have at least half of the world's population agreeing with me. Yeah? Yeah. You know, once in a while you do read an interview from a woman who says, I'm doing this voluntarily, yeah? So that's fine, yeah. But most people, it's really, you know, when you're a little kid and everybody's saying what they want to be when they grow up, you know? Nobody says, I want to be a prostitute when I grow up. And nobody says, I want to be a prison guard when I grow up either, yeah? Interesting. Anyway, that's off the topic. But, so I think I'm going to teach it in a more modern way according to our culture. Yeah? But we can discuss it, okay? So, I mean, so some of the things that Vasubandhu put in, you can see that it's related to that culture at that time. So just to give you an example, having sex during the daytime was considered unwise and unkind sexual behavior. Why? If you look in ancient India, Well, even right now in the villages, everybody lives in one room. They have little huts. The whole family lives in one room. Everybody's out working during the day. Yeah. If you're sitting in the family's room in daylight when you should be out in the field, you know, some people are going to be pretty unhappy about it. Okay, so you can see how that fits that kind of cultural situation. Yeah. Here it doesn't fit. Okay? So, but some things, yeah. So a person who obviously you shouldn't have sex with, somebody who's celibate, okay? Here it says somebody in the custody of their parents. Yeah? So a child, basically. Now at what point somebody stops being a child? I don't know that you could set a particular age limit on it. Yeah, but definitely, you know, sleeping with, having sex with young children would be unwise and unkind and downright, you know, downright harmful. They also say somebody, you know, who's a close relative. Yeah. Now, that makes sense in a society where there's no birth control. In a society where there's birth control and somebody's using it, I don't know. Yeah. It would probably create a bit of a tumult in the family if brothers and sisters were sleeping together, though. Yeah. So, but here it says within 7 generations, so I don't know. I don't even know cousins beyond 2 generations, so. Yeah. It's an interesting one. Like, you know, because they talk a lot about now, you know, so because there's so many children whose father was sperm donor number whatever, so they're not, they don't know who their father was, and, you know, what happens if 2 children who actually are children from the same sperm donor get together? Okay, not so good, you know, what is it, genetically, or that kind of thing. But of course, if people don't know, would that be unwise and unkind? I don't think so. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so to have it be a complete action, you have sex with the person that you intended to. Although it's interesting, in the Gongchen Lamrim it says that the identification can be mistaken. But in other texts it says you have to sleep with the one that you intended to. You have to have the intention to do it. And it's usually done with attachment as a motivation, but it could be done with anger. For example, again, when armies rape the women, to terrorize the population. It can also be done out of ignorance, thinking that having sex is some high spiritual practice, or thinking that it's very fashionable to have an extramarital affair, or thinking there's nothing really wrong with it, nobody will find out, it helps me let off steam, you know, so those kind of excuses. There's probably attachment mixed in with that, but also ignorance. It's somehow making excuses, saying, well, it's all okay, it doesn't really matter. Now, nothing is said in here about the possibility of sexually transmitted diseases. In ancient times, nobody thought about that. So there's no commentary about that. To update that to a more modern situation, I would say having sex with unprotected sex when there's danger of an STD would fall into breaking this precept. Yeah? Because it's potentially damaging to yourself, damaging to the other person, damaging to other people who the other person may sleep with afterwards. Yeah. And so I think, you know, not taking precautions so that diseases are not spread, I would put that under unwise and unkind sexual behavior. Yeah. Also, what I would put under that, because according to the old way, if two people are consenting adults, fine. Yeah. It's just if somebody's married to somebody, yeah, then you shouldn't sleep with that person. Yeah. But in our situation, in our culture, I don't think it's just if somebody's married to somebody else you shouldn't be sleeping with them. It's if they're in a relationship with somebody else. Doesn't matter if they're married or not. Or if you're in a relationship with somebody else and you're going with somebody who's not in a relationship. The whole idea is that people are kind of playing musical chairs, musical partners, and it creates havoc in families. And so many people have come and said to me, you know, when I was little, I knew, it's usually dad, but sometimes mom, but you know, I knew one of my parents was having an affair. And probably the parent who was having the affair thought, nobody's going to find out about this, and the kids aren't going to know, and my spouse isn't going to know. But usually people find out about it. So it creates a lot of tumult. Now, an interesting question is, what happens when people say that they want to have an open relationship? Okay? You can sleep with other people, I can sleep with other people, it's all okay. Okay? So it sounds very good, especially to people of my generation. Yeah. But I remember someone who was here at the Abbey sharing that, you know, when she was young, that's the way she and her partner set up their relationship. They could both go sleep with other people. And she said it was a disaster. Yeah, because what you think intellectually is going to be okay, when you get down to the nuts and bolts, people are jealous and people are hurt. And it creates a whole lot of confusion and a great big mess. Another thing that I would say, that I would put in this, and you know, I was present when this was being discussed with His Holiness, because I was at one of the Western Buddhist teachers' meetings, and somebody was saying that for Thich Nhat Hanh, he says that the couple has to have fondness, you know, they have to love each other, some kind of positive emotion has to be involved. It shouldn't just be casual sex of hooking up. And His Holiness's reply was interesting. He said, well, that's not specified, you know, in the, you know, specifications according to Vasubandhu. He said, I think that's a very good idea. Yeah. Because if, you know, first of all, there's somebody might get pregnant. Yeah. But even aside from that, if people aren't really, if they don't have some genuine care for them, one person could be getting attached while the other person is saying, oh, it's all okay. Yeah, we're both consenting adults. We agreed to do this. We agreed to have an open relationship. Or even if it's just a hookup, you know, oh, we agreed this is all fine. But actually, in fact, somebody is developing some attachment, some emotional attachment. Yeah, so one person's developing attachment, the other person saying, oh, this is all fine, and kind of using their partner for their own sexual pleasure, whereas the partner is getting attached to them. So that's not a good scene, is it? Yeah, somebody's going to get hurt. And there's going to be some bad feelings, and there's going to be some blow up about that. So I would put that under this too. You know, having sexual relationships when you know, one or the other person may be getting attached. Yeah. No matter what they say, we have to look at what's actually maybe going on inside of them. What do you people think? Yeah?
I think a good number of people are unaware of their own sexuality in appropriate depth. I think that's the basis. And so, you know, I think you definitely say don't have sex with people under 12. I mean, there's certain things that are, you know. But I think for most people, you really have to look at it from the point of view of whether or not I'm going to do something compassionate here or not. And you can't
just say that last part about compassion.
You have to say to yourself, you have to really look at your mind and say, am I doing something with compassion and care or not? And that's really all these other things like this rule or that rule. They're guidelines, but the real thing is, am I doing something that's compassionate for me, and am I doing something that's compassionate for the other person? Mm-hmm. And really think about it deeply. And I think, because I used to teach sexuality, and my experience with that is that most people, especially young people, are very confused.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Most people nowadays are very confused because the media just puts it out like this is the biggest thing in your whole life and it's the biggest thrill you're ever going to have and the highest bliss. And if it were really the highest bliss that's going to make you everlastingly happy, how come you have to keep doing it? Yeah, it doesn't make you everlastingly happy. But there's this kind of rumor and that the media builds up on, and so young people especially are very confused. And you know what? I think sometimes older people are confused too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think people get very confused, and the thing is, the attachment, sexual attachment, is the strongest attachment we have in the human realm. And when that grabs somebody, their mind's out to lunch. You know, people don't think. Would you agree?
Yeah. I think that times are very different from when we were teenagers, mm-hmm. legally. Like, I don't know, I just can't imagine that it's safe for a person over 18 to have sex with a person under 18.
No, it's not. Even
it
now.
That way when we were that age.
No, when we were that age also, you
well,
couldn't.
Maybe you couldn't, but it wasn't.
It wasn't prosecuted
it wasn't,
as much.
Yeah, it wasn't discussed. I mean, things have really changed.
Yeah, things are very different now. Yeah.
It's a long time ago now.
But it's true, but you're right. And when we were teenagers, people over 18, men over 18, having sex with women, girls under 18, was often not prosecuted, was not discussed.
Yeah.
And that was...
And that's also because people didn't talk about it.
And the other thing is that was the major condition for abortions. Most people who got abortions that were under 18 or having sex with men that were over 18. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that people need to think about. We need to think about what are the consequences of my behavior? What mm-hmm. are the long-term consequences?
Yep. And especially regarding having kids. And if you don't want to have kids, use birth control. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Often statutory rape laws are state by state, and
yes.
16 is a really common age in this country.
Yeah, sometimes it's 18, sometimes 16.
Yes. And some states, even, I don't know, they probably changed it. Some of the states had 13.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what about two 10-year-olds together? What about people that are both minors?
Yeah. Is that wise? You know, two 13-year-olds? Do they have any clue?
No.
What's going on?
Actually, they do because they watch music videos. And, you know, anymore it's like a porn movie instead of music. You know, mm-hmm. One Dharma student said he sat down and watched a music video with his young daughter who was 12 or 13, and he felt like he was watching porn with her. And it was, you know, because they're quite graphic anymore.
Huh.
It's, where do you draw the line? How do you...
Yeah.
Oh, you're right.
So it is true, though, that if people are becoming physically sexually mature earlier, it's also true that because of the availability of pornography on the internet, that most boys by the age of 9 have seen hours and hours and hours of really horrific sex, and it's a problem in our culture.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing parents need to think about. If they wait to have the conversation after 9, they're divorced.
Yeah. And what about watching porn? Should that be put in with unwise and unkind sexual behavior? Because people are being made into objects. Yeah. Now, it's true, some people choose to do porn movies. Yeah. But what about the people watching them? Yeah, is that something we want to say is okay? I mean, look at what it does to your mind. Now, we're going to have a whole big discussion. Like I told you, this is always the biggest thing. Everybody's going to have something to say because it's about sex. So do you want to have this discussion, or should I keep going on? Yeah.
I have one last thing to say.
One scandal that everybody can understand. You know, understanding the financial scandals that people get into, that's hard, isn't it? You know, they did this and that, bought this and equities with that, we don't know what the vocabulary. But, you know, when they talk about politicians running off with their mistresses, everybody understands. Although I heard that it was very difficult for some parents to explain some of the terminology to their young children during the Clinton years. Mommy, what does this mean? For monastics, it's very easy and simple. It's all, it's all verboten. And so it's very simple, you don't have to wonder about this, that, or the other thing. It's just, I know one word in German.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, most of the actions are, if you tell somebody else to do them, then it's, you also accumulate the karma of doing them. They say that, this one is not one of those, okay? That you, to have the action of unwise and unkind sexual behavior. You have to do it yourself. You can't tell somebody else to do it. However, okay, in the Yoga Charya Bhumi by Maitreya, according to the Tibetans, and I think by Asanga, according to the Chinese, if one causes someone else to commit sexual misconduct, oneself incurs this deed as well. But the Abhidharma Kosha says it's not an actual path of action. You have to actually do it for yourself. And Tsongkhapa said that Asanga's explanation may mean that it's a fault which is not an actual path of action, meaning that it's not something that's good to do, it's something you should avoid doing, but it's not an actual path of action. So it may be another one of these things we need to think about, and that also depends on many different circumstances. Okay, where are we? We're time to end, aren't we? Any more questions? Maybe people online? Yeah?
There was one from last week that just said, if we happen to see a $50 note on the path and there isn't anyone looking for it, could we pick it up and put it in a donation box or just leave it?
That question gets asked a lot. I'm not quite sure on the answer, because on one hand, picking it up, you're taking something that isn't freely given. And somebody may realize that they dropped it and go back looking for it. And then it won't be there because you picked it up. Yeah. On the other hand, you just leave it there and, maybe it gets washed away in the rain or something like that. My tendency would be more, depending where it is, if you can pick it up and take it to a lost and found, do that. Otherwise, maybe leave it there. Or what I often do, if I find things lying by the way that I think somebody dropped, put it up high where somebody can see it. So if you have a piece of plastic, put it around the bill and then put it up high where if somebody's looking for it, they might see it. Somebody else may come back by and take it, but that isn't our business.
Yeah. If we're paying taxes and the money goes to finance things we are opposed to, such as war, factory farms, how do we make sense of this since withholding taxes is stealing?
Okay, so how about when the taxes are being used for unethical things? You write on your tax check, this is what I used to do, do not use this for war. Yeah? Use this for education. Use this for food stamps. Use it to benefit people. This money is not to be used for armaments. Yeah? So you just write it on your check, because you have to send your check, your taxes in. And then you see it as your money's going to benefit others.
Mm-hmm. I lived very poor for a long time, partially because I didn't want to make enough money to pay taxes, because I didn't want to go for war.
Yeah.
And I don't know if writing on the check is going to make them decide where to put the money or not.
No, but it makes us.
It's your intention.
Because it's our intention of where we want the money to go. Because not all of the money goes to war. Yeah? So why can't we direct our money to go for education or health or something like that? Yeah? It's our intention. We're putting it there. And some money will be used for those things. So it's our money.
Sometimes I get kind of trouble in my own mind when we get down to these little fine details about even who paid for the prostitute, but those kinds of things. When on one hand, karma, the details of karma are so complex that only a Buddha knows them.
Right.
And on the other hand, our intent to harm or our intent is really the starts to get into this feeling of the thou shalt not part. And then going back to Vasubandhu those kinds of rules. So anyway, this is so that sort of feeling that comes up when we start to parse.
But I think you can put both of the things of what you're saying, that karma is so complicated, only the Buddha knows it completely. But he does know that certain actions do bring painful results.
Yes.
And that's why he described these 10. Yeah. Okay. But we also are told that our motivation is the most important thing. Yeah. But that isn't saying the motivation is the only thing. Okay? So it's the most important, so we always check our mind. But we also have to pay attention to other things too. And nobody in this whole thing is saying thou shalt not, except your own mind.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's what it hits.
Yeah. The Buddha did not say thou shalt not do these things. Buddha said you're a free individual. I'm describing this so that you can have the information for making good decisions. If you don't believe it, fine, do what you want. But be aware that, you know, whatever you do is going to bring results. Yeah. Now, if the Buddha says a result of something is something that you think, well, that shouldn't be the result of this, you know, then you have to think about it. Yeah, does doing that action in that way with that intention, you know, could it possibly bring that kind of result? And then you think about it yourself and decide. Okay, nobody's saying thou shalt not. Only your own mind. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it helps. And it's not even the Buddha, it's more the Vasubandhu.
Yeah. Well, this is what's so interesting. And see, why is it this precept?
Right. Yeah.
Why do the other precepts usually go down so well, but the one on sex, people get so fired up about? Why?
Because women have traditionally been oppressed.
That's why the world gets so fired up about it?
Well, I think in terms of Vasubandhu, he's saying things that are oppressive for women.
But for the things are just as oppressive for men, too. If you read what he says, it's just bad for everybody.
Yeah. I think it's more the attitude of, I should be able to do what I want with my body.
Yes, that's it. I want to do what I want to do. And you're telling me I can't do this. Yeah. So, you know, again, Vasubandhu is just spelling it out. Now, you have to decide, do you believe Vasubandhu? You know, if the Buddha didn't mention all these details in the sutras, do you trust Vasubandhu enough? Yeah, to think that he's telling the truth? Or do you say, well, Vasubandhu also taught that the world was flat? So, you know, and anyway, he's saying what I don't want to hear. So, we have to check our own mind. We have to check our own mind. And there's some things we may think about. This is the kind of stuff that Alex did. He made, he was talking about, you know, let's say somebody's handicapped. I'm not using the right word.
Disabled.
Yeah, somebody's disabled, then shouldn't the rules be a little bit different for that person? Yeah, and are they rules or are they guidelines? But my question is, why this precept? That's what I'm asking you to, I don't want to discuss it. I want you to think about it. Why? I already told you the answer. But you need to think, why is this one the most controversial? Okay. Now, of course, when it comes to taking the 5 precepts, you know, most people will take, who come to the point of taking precepts, they'll take the 3rd one. Most people, some people won't. The one most people won't take is the 5th one on intoxicants. Why don't they want to take the precept on intoxicants? Okay? So I'm just asking you to think, you know, why in your life do certain things, you know, push a button and make you go berserky? You know, how have you been conditioned by society? How have you been conditioned by society to think? Yeah. Have you been conditioned to think that this is oppressive, or this is okay, or this is this, or this is that? You know? And what do you really believe? And is this a political discussion, or is it an ethical discussion?
It's interesting that His Holiness has called Vasubandhu out on Mount Meru and some of those geological things, geographical things, but why hasn't this come up in the last, 1600 years, you know, as another topic to investigate?
Because people in Tibet don't talk about sex, they just do it. They don't even, in Tibetan culture, you don't even say the word, you spell it out. People do not talk about it.
What about the Chinese tradition? How's it?
I don't think they talk about it there either. Yeah. But we love to talk about everything, don't we? Especially, let's talk about sex. Isn't this interesting? Doesn't it get boring talking about sex? You know? I mean, it's like... Yeah?
This is not about sex.
Good, thank you.
So I've been thinking quite a few times now about, like, the internet.
About what?
Internet. So I wanted to hear, because like, for example, a website, when, let's say Shavasti Abbey or even your website, the teaching. So like when initially with the technology available, you know, it was about sharing. But now technology has moved so fast that I can take the videos out of it, I can do many things out of this that may not have been intended then with that technology. Mm-hmm. But now, with additional technology, a lot of things are being capable of. And where is the limit, and then where the copyrights is?
Yes, actually, thank you for bringing this up. I totally spaced out and forgot about it. You know, again, I think we have to go by the rules that have been set up. Yeah. So, you know, getting software that's duplicated, that's, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, you're not supposed to do that kind of thing. Now, if there's, you can't get the software, and there's no other way to get it by legally purchasing it, then I don't know, maybe it's okay to take software, you know, that's been copied. But,
Free. All these softwares are free online. You can get anything you want practically free.
Free.
To do anything.
Yeah, but is it free from the people who made it?
Yes. So
if people make it, I mean, like the Abbey, we put all our videos online. It's all free. Now, if somebody else took one of the videos, transcribed it, and turned it in as a term paper, which I'm sure some people have done. Yeah? I'm sure. I mean, Lakshya Sama once told me, I wonder how many, because I've written so many master's dissertations, you know, master's thesis, you know, because people are always coming, they want an interview, you give them an interview, you spend all the time telling them something, hours and hours, they write it up and they get the degree. Yeah. So, you know, I think, like, with the Abbey, I mean, we put it on, we're happy for people to listen to it. If somebody writes it up and presents it as their own material, that's lying. Okay? Yeah, and it wasn't freely given for the purpose of turning in as a thesis or a class paper or something like that. That's not the purpose of the freely given. We do have copyright on it, but you know. In terms of books, I would say always best to buy the book. But if there's a short part in it, you know, a few pages you need to photocopy for something, you know, I think that's probably okay. But if you're in doubt, write to the publisher, write to the author, and ask them if they can use the you know, if you can use the material. Okay, so just because it's on the internet, you have to think of the creator of the material. It wants it used for that purpose, not just if the person whose website it's on wants it used like that.
What about like personal use? Just getting the information for personal use. Like for example, just the phone. Today the phone, if there is a page or document, whatever, that is not able, that you're not able to download as a PDF, you can take an instant picture with the phone, with the image in there.
Yeah, well, if it's something that you're doing research on and you can't, you know, like on Google Books, you know, you can't copy it or something like that. But it's you're using it for your own private information, so you take a picture of a page. I don't think that is so bad because they put the pages on there for you to read and you're using it for your own information. If you took the picture and then started giving it around to all sorts of other people and it wasn't intended by the person who put it up to be used in that way, yeah, then I would say that there's some copyright infringement. Yeah. So I think that there's a big deal between personal use and to give around to other people. Yeah. And if it's one page versus if you're photocopying, you know, half a book. Yeah, a big difference that way. But that's just my thought. Somebody else may have different thoughts about it. Let's dedicate.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Sun's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Mandala Kandiratayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born of no decline but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the